The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. If we have some time, that's the hope, that's the plan. If we have some time later on in the show, hopefully we can roll through quite a few emails that I was able to collect this morning and give you some feedback from your fellow listeners. Well, on today's, or rather yesterday's show, I mentioned that in walking through the Coventry Transport Museum, if you haven't heard that program, you can listen to it at thetrumpet.com or at kpcg.fm. But I mentioned that in walking through that Transport Museum last week, I couldn't help but think about Chapter 12 of The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that chapter on the birthright at its zenith. And then now, where we are today, and you can walk through that museum in Coventry and actually see when the birthright was at its zenith, when we peaked in power and might. And in that same museum, you might have to read between the lines in some cases, but you can also get a pretty good visual of where we are today, where we are now. The birthright at its zenith, and now, Mr. Armstrong wrote. That's chapter 12 of The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And this is how he introduced the chapter. How great, how powerful, and how wealthy did the British and American people become? And what is suddenly happening to us now, he asks. Why has Britain already lost most of her colonies, her possessions, her resources, wealth, power, and influence in the world? Why is Britain no longer considered Great Britain, a great world power? And then he says here, why is the United States now discredited, despised, hated throughout so much of the world? Why could we not win the Korean War? Why couldn't the United States whip little North Vietnam? Why couldn't we win these relatively small skirmishes? That's Mr. Armstrong asking those questions in, when was that last version of U.S. and BIP put to the printer? That was in 1980, I guess. Why couldn't we win the Korean War? Why couldn't we beat North Vietnam? It makes me think of the other statement that we really draw attention to, and he was right. It's from Mystery of the Ages, and Mr. Armstrong used it or made the statement elsewhere. But in Mystery of the Ages, Chapter 5 on Mystery of Israel, Mr. Armstrong says, after the year 1800, and here again we've talked about these blessings quite often, these past few programs are quite a lot over the last week. After the year 1800, we prospered because of Abraham's obedience and God's unbreakable promise to him. But now, having received such individual and national prosperity, we sin by stealing from God. That has brought our nations under a curse. And then he says, we have won our last war. We have won our last war. Nothing but troubles now lie ahead until we repent. As I say, we draw a lot of attention to that statement. We've won our last war. We draw a lot of attention to that. And he was right, because Mr. Armstrong was right. And you look at the history. Like he says in U.S. and Britain, of course, he's writing in 1980. That was the last version. And what would he be saying today, given the string of defeats? There was a piece in Real Clear World yesterday by Andrew Bakovich that just graphically illustrates the truth of that statement made by Mr. Armstrong. He titled it The Swamp of War. drawing on that statement Donald Trump made over and again during the campaign. He's going to Washington to drain the swamp. He's going to get rid of all the problems. He's going to get rid of all of the career politicians. He's going to drain the swamp and fix everything. Well, in this particular piece, The Swamp of War, Mr. Bakovich opens the article by discussing Donald Trump's critique of America's top military brass. How that he had said over and again in the campaign that they weren't winning. They weren't winning battles. They weren't winning wars. And Bakovich draws attention to that 60 Minutes interview that we've played some excerpts from over the past couple of weeks. This is a short clip from that 60 Minutes interview from a couple of weeks ago.
We have great generals.
You said you knew more than the generals about ISIS.
I'll be honest with you, I probably do, because look at the job they've done. Okay, look at the job they've done. They haven't done the job.
Okay, so we have great generals, he says, on the one hand, and then when pressed further, he knows more than the generals because they haven't done the job. And in this piece by Mr. Bakovich, he doesn't come across as a big fan of Donald Trump. But as he brings out at the start of his piece, it's hard to argue with that last statement Mr. Trump made. They haven't done the job. They haven't done the job. Bakovich writes, in reality, Trump, the former reality show host, knows next to nothing about ISIS. One of many gaps in his education that his impending encounter with actual reality is likely to fill. Yet when it comes to America's generals, our president-to-be is on to something. No doubt our 3 or 4 star officers qualify as great in the sense that they mean well, they work hard, and are altogether fine men and women. That they have not done the job, however, is indisputable. At least if their job is to bring America's wars to a timely and successful conclusion. So he's basically saying that, well, yes, we have hard workers at the top among the military brass. They work hard, they're good people. But the undeniable truth is that they haven't been winning. America hasn't been winning. We've been losing wars. We've been losing conflicts. In this article, he says, Trump's unhappy verdict that the senior U.S. military leadership doesn't know how to win applies in spades to the two principal conflicts of the post-9/11 era, the Afghanistan War, now in its 16th year, and the Iraq War, launched in 2003, and after a brief hiatus, once more grinding on. Yet the verdict applies equally to lesser theaters of conflict, largely overlooked by the American public, that in recent years have engaged the attention of U.S. forces, a list that would include conflicts in Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. The list goes on and on, these principal conflicts, just in this century, just in the first 16 years of this century. We have won our last war. Herbert Armstrong was right. He was right. Donald Trump gave his assessment somewhat arrogantly on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago. Mr. Armstrong gave his assessment based on the sure word of Bible prophecy. He gave it decades ago. Decades ago. In this article, The Swamp of War, Bakovich says, granted, our generals have demonstrated an impressive aptitude for moving pieces around on a dauntingly complex military chessboard. Brigades, battle groups, and squadrons shuttle in and out of various war zones, responding to the needs of the moment. The sheer immensity of the enterprise across the greater Middle East and Northern Africa, the sorties flown, munitions expended, the seamless deployment and redeployment of thousands of troops over thousands of miles, the vast stockpiles of military or material positioned, expended, and continuously resupplied represents a staggering achievement. Measured by these or similar quantifiable outputs, America's military has excelled. No other military establishment in history could have come close to duplicating the logistical feats being performed year in, year out by the armed forces of the United States. But, as he brings out, does this constitute success? Does the fact that we can ship brigades and battle groups and squadrons all over the world, in and out of regions, tens of thousands of troops, all of this equipment, the vast stockpiles of material positioned, expended, and continuously resupplied, does that constitute success? Does that mean we've accumulated victories? He brings out in this piece that since 9/11, something like 370,000 combatants and non-combatants have been killed in the various theaters of operations where U.S. forces have been active. Now, by historical standards, that 370,000 deaths might seem like a relatively small amount, but this harvest of death, as Bakovich calls it, is hardly trivial. In other words, the United States has gone into these areas, these regions, and, well, they haven't been able to fulfill their objectives. They haven't won. They haven't succeeded. Now, think about this as in connection with the prophecies we've been reviewing over the last week, Leviticus 26 in particular, where God said if we didn't obey him, if we turned to false gods, he said he would set his face against us. He said we'd be slain before our enemies. He said those that hate you would reign over you. And that when others pursued us, we'd flee away, we'd run from it. Then he says, I'll punish you seven times more for your sins. Now we've gone through the delay, those blessings being suspended, 2,520 years. But now that God has fulfilled his will, now that God has kept his promise made to Abraham, re-promised to Isaac, and again to Jacob, he's under no obligation to continue pouring those blessings down upon us. It's like Herbert Armstrong said in Mystery of the Ages, Chapter 5. We've received all of these blessings, this national prosperity, and we respond to that by effectively stealing from God. That brings our nations under a curse. We have won our last war. And what does it say here in Leviticus 26, verse 19? I'll break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron, and your earth as brass. The pride in our power, it's been broken. And so we said, back at the start, back right after 9/11, based on prophecy, following on what Herbert Armstrong said, years and years and years before we did it, we said that while the U.S. wants to eliminate terrorism, and it's ramping up efforts to fight against it, we said those efforts will fall short. That's a direct quote from the Trumpet magazine. America, frankly, does not have the necessary will to tackle the enormity of the problem. That's from thetrumpet.com, November 2001, or the Trumpet magazine, November 2001. And what else does it say in Leviticus 26? Well, the very next verse, I'll break the pride of your power. And then the next verse says, and your strength shall be spent in vain. Your strength shall be spent. I mean, God uses the word spent. I mean, there is a lot of activity going on. Just like this man covers in his piece, the swamp of war. Well, the generals, of course, they've been out there demonstrating an impressive aptitude for moving pieces around on a dauntingly complex military chessboard. All these brigades, these battle groups, these squadrons, all of these various war zones. Just the sheer immensity of the enterprise across the greater Middle East, Northern Africa. And there's lots of strength being spent. But what God prophesies in Leviticus 26 and verse 20 is that all of this intense effort would yield little or no results in return. That's what it means to spend your strength in vain. Well, just look at the dollar amount. To take one example, at 9/11, the national debt in the United States was $5.7 trillion. That was back in 2001. Today it's right near $20 trillion. I mean, we've managed through these difficult years, this war against terrorism, to increase our debt burden at this unfathomable rate of nearly $1 trillion per year. Strength spent in vain. Now, in Bakovich's piece, he says here, yet in evaluating military operations, it's a mistake to confuse how much with how well. There's a lot of strength. There's a lot of equipment. There's a lot of troops. There's a lot of different theaters that the United States is in. There's a lot of sorties flown, munitions expended, deployment, redeployment, tens of thousands of troops, thousands of miles away from America. But we can't confuse how much with how well. He writes, only rarely do the outcomes of armed conflicts turn on comparative statistics. Ultimately, the one measure of success that really matters involves achieving war's political purposes. By that standard, victory requires not simply the defeat of the enemy, but accomplishing the nation's stated war aims, and not just in part or temporarily, but definitively. Anything less constitutes failure, not to mention utter waste for taxpayers and for those called upon to fight. It constitutes cause for mourning. Bakovich says here, by that standard, having been at war for virtually the entire 21st century, the United States military is still looking for its first win. How about that? Having been at war for 16 years, and we're still looking for our first victory. He says, however strong the disinclination to concede that Donald Trump could be right about anything, his verdict on American generalship qualifies as apt. Trump's right, in other words. But the thing is, Herbert Armstrong was right 50 years before that, before Trump started talking about it this year. And of course, Moses was right 3,400 years ago when God inspired him to write down Leviticus 26. In this Real Clear World piece, the author goes on to then ask three questions. Firstly, why have the recurring shortcomings of America's military leadership largely escaped notice? How come no one seems to pay attention or to care about this lack of leadership at the highest level of the U.S. military? And then he asks, secondary to that, does this faulty generalship, does it explain why victory has proven to be so elusive? And then he asks, thirdly, You know, what can we do if there's a deficiency in leadership in the top brass of the military? What can we do to change that, to improve it, so that the outcome of these many wars can be different, so that we might finally win? Well, he gives a history lesson, referring back to the time here in, around Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War period, prefacing it by saying this: 21st century Americans, inured to wars that never end, have long since forgotten that bringing such conflicts to a prompt and successful conclusion once defined the very essence of what generals were expected to do. You've got to bring this to a successful conclusion as promptly as possible. That's what constitutes your success as a leader, as a general. Well, then he takes us back to this period during the Civil War. It says, back then, standards employed in evaluating generalship were clear-cut and uncompromising. Those who won battles earned fame, glory, and the gratitude of their countrymen. Those who lost battles got fired or were put out to pasture. That's the way it used to be. It was just that simple. During the Civil War, he writes, Abraham Lincoln did not need an advanced degree in strategic studies to conclude that Union generals like John Pope, Ambrose Burnside, and Joseph Hooker didn't have what it took to defeat the Army of Northern Virginia. Humiliating defeats sustained by the Army of the Potomac at the Second Bull Run, Fredericksburg, and Chancellorsville made that obvious enough. Similarly, the victories Ulysses S. Grant and William T. Sherman gained at Shiloh, at Vicksburg, and in the Chattanooga campaign strongly suggested that here was a team to which the president could entrust the task of bringing the Confederacy to its knees. It all came down to successful leadership. He says, today, public drunkenness, petty corruption, or sexual shenanigans with a subordinate might land generals in hot water, but as long as they avoid egregious misbehavior, senior officers charged with prosecuting America's wars are largely spared judgments of any sort. In other words, it doesn't matter what they do or don't do on the battlefield, whether they win or don't win, as long as their personal behavior doesn't get too bad, then they're given a free pass. He says, with the country's political leaders and public conditioned to conflicts seemingly destined to drag on for years, if not decades, no one expects the current general-in-chief in Iraq or Afghanistan to bring things to a successful conclusion. His job is merely to manage the situation until he passes it along to a successor, while duly adding to his collection of personal decorations and perhaps advancing his career. This is what it's come down to for so many of America's top generals. They're just kind of like short-term managers. Maintain the status quo, and then hand it over to the next guy. And then in this next section of the article, it just makes your head shake. It's not even that long ago. This is very recent history. But just throwing out the names, well, like he did with the example in the Civil War era. I mean, you didn't need to have all of these advanced degrees to figure out which ones were winning for you. Notice this quote from the Swamp of War. Today, for example, Army General John Nicholson commands U.S. and Allied forces in Afghanistan. So we have General Nicholson there now. He's only the latest in a long line of senior officers to preside over that war, beginning with General Tommy Franks in 2001 and continuing with Generals Mikuleshik, Barno, Eikenberry, McNeil, McKiernan, McChrystal, Petraeus, Allen, Dunford, and Campbell. That's Nicholson, Mikulashik, Barno, Eikenberry, McNeil, McKiernan, McChrystal, Petraeus, Allen, Dunford, and Campbell. That's 11, by my count, in 15 years, 16 years. He says the title carried by these officers changed over time. So too did the specifics of their mission. As Operation Enduring Freedom evolved into Operation Freedom's Sentinel. Yet even as expectations slipped lower and lower, none of the commanders rotating through Kabul delivered. Not a single one has, in our president-elect's concise formulation, done the job. Not a single one. Now, you can't put all the blame on those generals. They need a commander-in-chief, of course, that won't tie their hands behind their backs. But still, 11 generals presiding over the war in Afghanistan. And among those 11, I mean, which ones could you say, okay, there's the Ulysses Grant. There's William Sherman, for sure. Because they're getting us victories. It says here, indeed, it's increasingly difficult to know what that job is, apart from preventing the Taliban from quite literally toppling the government. And it's the same in Iraq. In Iraq, meanwhile, Army Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend currently serves as the, count 'em, 9th American to command U.S. and coalition forces in that country since the George W. Bush administration ordered the invasion in 2003. So we've had 9 in Iraq, 11 in Afghanistan. And what has been the result? Where are the victories? Speaking of Iraq here, he says the first in that line, once again, General Tommy Franks overthrew the Saddam Hussein regime and thereby broke Iraq. The next 5, Generals Sanchez, Casey, Petraeus, Odierno, and Austin, they labored for 8 years to put it back together again. Now, what prophecy does this make you think about? Well, you look at what Isaiah says. In Isaiah chapter 3, where it talks about God taking away the mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50, the honorable man, and on it goes. In other words, strong male leadership. And the absence of it is it's a curse, Isaiah says. It's a curse. God says he's removed these strong leaders. Because of our rebellion, God is removing this strong male leadership. And look around. I mean, look at the campaign in Afghanistan. Look at Iraq. Look at some of these other theaters. Look at some of the smaller conflicts in Libya, in Yemen, in Syria. Well, you can hardly say Syria is a smaller conflict. But look at the lack of leadership in the United States. Where are the mighty men of valor? Where are the great military generals of old? Where are the great men of wisdom and vision? The great communicators? Well, God says that in this end time, they would disappear. He would take them away. And that is a tremendous curse. It's a great curse. And it's discussed in Isaiah 3, and it's discussed in Leviticus 26. That Isaiah 3 passage, he says that in the place of these strong male leaders, the women and the children are going to fill the void. That's what he talks about later on in that chapter. Now, just think about Isaiah 3 and Leviticus 26 and some of these other earth-shaking prophecies. How much longer will our people be able to brush these prophecies aside as the archaic writings for an ancient people? Oh, it doesn't apply to today. It certainly doesn't apply to us. If anything, it's just talking about little Israel in the Middle East. We get a free pass. We're doing great. We've got great generals. I know more than them, and I'll fix the problem of not getting victories. These prophecies are so specific. They're so specific. The broken will, the strength spent in vain, the disappearance of true leaders, the man of war, the mighty man of war, the man of valor and strength. It just leaps off the page. You read a couple of paragraphs. All of the names. Mikolashek, Barno, McNeil, McKiernan, Townsend, Franks, Sanchez, Casey, Petraeus, Austin, McChrystal, Allen, Dunford, Campbell, Nicholson. That's just in the last 15 years. Continuing from this real clear world piece, at the end of 2001, President Obama declared that they had done just that and terminated the U.S. military occupation that we won, in other words. He comes in or says that everything's finished, it's a great success, and now we can go. It says the Islamic State soon exposed President Obama's claim as specious when its militants put a U.S.-trained Iraqi army to flight and annexed large swaths of that country's territory. This is what happened in Iraq just a few years ago, right after our so-called victory. Following in the footsteps of his immediate predecessors, Generals James Terry and Sean McFarland, General Townsend now shoulders the task of trying to restore Iraq's status as a more or less genuinely sovereign state. He directs what the Pentagon calls Operation Inherent Resolve, dating from June 2014, the follow-up to Operation New Dawn, which was itself the successor to Operation Iraqi Freedom. It says here in this article, when and how Inherent Resolve will conclude is difficult to forecast. This much we can, however, say, with some confidence, with the end nowhere in sight, General Townsend won't be its last commander. Other generals are waiting in the wings and with their own careers to polish. As in Kabul, the parade of U.S. military commanders through Baghdad will continue. Yes, indeed, it's just like a revolving door. Some of these names are now being recycled or given consideration for positions in Donald Trump's administration. It says here in the article, and again, I need to read a lot of this. I know it's a lot of quoting here, but it's an important piece because it really does. It really does illuminate some of these prophecies we've been telling you about for so many years. He says, for some readers, this listing of mostly forgotten names and dates may have a soporific effect, or it just may put you to sleep. Yet it should also drive home Trump's point. The United States may today have the world's most powerful and capable military, so at least we are constantly told. Yet the record shows that it does not have a core of senior officers who know how to translate capability into successful outcomes. In other words, we have the firepower, or at least that's what we're constantly told. But we lack the leadership to effectively use it. Well, that's prophesied. It's also prophesied that we would lose the pride that we once had in our power. God also says we have a lot of strength. but that we keep spending it in vain. That's prophesied. Can Donald Trump fix all of this? Is he the one that can make America great again? Can he make the American military great again? We had a piece on that at thetrumpet.com just in the last couple days. Well, as my father says in the Great Again booklet, no man, no political party is going to be able to do this. Now, during his campaign, he did promise to defeat radical Islamic terrorism. At least he'll call it by its name, Mr. Trump. He said he's going to decimate Al-Qaeda. He said he's going to bomb ISIS. He indicated that he might starve the funding for Hamas and Hezbollah, or reimpose sanctions on Iran. And he may do some things early on in his administration. He may reopen or repopulate, I guess I should say. It's not quite shut down, and President Obama is certainly working to that end. But he may repopulate Guantanamo. He may snap those sanctions back in place for Iran. He may bomb ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or whoever. But will it solve the problem? Will he all of a sudden discover these great generals of old that will lead the United States to victory? That will start getting victories for the United States? Well, what does Bible prophecy say? We're not trying to be pessimistic. There is hope in the end, like the prophet Jeremiah said. But there's also no hope in man, as the prophet Jeremiah also said. There's hope in the end. Hope in God. There's no hope in man. Well, I'll bring you near to the conclusion of this piece. This is from Real Clear World, The Swamp of War. It says here, in the immediate wake of 9/11, George W. Bush concocted a fantasy of American soldiers liberating. Again, this author here, this journalist, is pretty much in favor of just getting out of all conflict, period. And that's not going to solve everything, for sure. In any event, he does lay out some important facts, just some important history to remember. Terry, McFarland, Townsend, Dunford, Campbell, Eikenberry, McNeil, Petraeus, Allen. These great, quote-unquote, military leaders that so many people have mostly forgotten. And no victories to show for it. In any event, he says George W. Bush concocted a fantasy of American soldiers liberating oppressed Afghans and Iraqis and thereby draining the swamp that served to incubate anti-Western terrorism. President Bush, he was going to send our troops in there to drain the swamp. The results achieved proved beyond disappointing, while the costs exacted in terms of lives and dollars squandered were painful indeed. Incrementally, with the passage of time, many Americans concluded that perhaps the swamp most in need of attention was not on the far side of the planet, but much closer to home. Right in the Imperial City nestled alongside the Potomac River. Right in Washington, D.C., in other words. And, of course, Donald Trump came into the election promising to drain the swamp in Washington. And many Americans rallied around that message. It says here, finally, this is the last bit, all signs indicate that in one fashion or another, our combative next president will perpetuate the wars he's inheriting. I mean, just look at some of the things he's some of the promises have been contradictory. We're going to pull back. We're going to let NATO fend for itself. And yet we're going to go over there and we're going to bomb ISIS. We're going to eliminate Al-Qaeda. It says Trump may fancy that as a veteran of Celebrity Apprentice, but not of military service, he possesses a special knack for spotting the next Grant or Sherman. But acting on that impulse will merely replenish the swamp in the greater Middle East, along with the one in Washington. And soon enough, those who elected him with expectations of seeing the much-despised establishment dismantled will realize that they've been had. Is he draining the swamp, whether in Washington or in the military or abroad? Well, you look at some of his more recent appointments, and these are insiders. These are lobbyists. These are members of the establishment. He's not going to be able to solve it. He's part of the problem, sad to say. And it's no slight on him. I mean, he's part of the problem. We're seeing Isaiah 3 play out before our eyes. And even with the promise of helping our veterans and rebuilding our military, putting more billions and billions more into the Army, the Navy. Well, I've got another article here from motherboard.com pointing out that Mr. Trump could put tens of billions into the military and actually make the problem worse. And this piece, I won't take the time to read as much with this one, but it goes through some of the history, just the recent history, and you put this together with the lack of leadership. They're pointing out all of these programs that the Pentagon got behind in 2003 or 2007 or 2011. And then they saw, well, with this counterinsurgency here or this kind of warfare here or the shadow warfare here, we can't use that kind of traditional equipment. So we've got to scrap that project and we've got to put our money towards something else. And it's just wasted hundreds of billions of dollars. And we've talked on this program and on Trumpet Hour about other programs that have cost tens of billions of dollars, where it's just been a complete and total waste of money. This article from motherboard.com gives example. The future combat systems in 2009. Well, and then a leader comes along and says, no, I think it was Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. He canceled it. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. Same with the Army's Crusader howitzer. Same with the Comanche from 2004. $10 billion worth of work down the drain. He says in 2005, the Army began to work on a new and much simpler scout chopper, the Arapaho, to replace the Comanche, and quickly. But the prototype was a sloppy rush job. It suffered an engine failure during testing in 2007. The Army killed off the program a year later, flushing no less than $500 million down the drain. Well, it's like this was one of the emails that I was going to read to you in the next segment. It's like one of our listeners wrote just today. This was in response to yesterday's show on the Motor City program. Coventry, blessings and cursings. He says here, what a shame that the greatness of our nations is now confined to museums with only relics of the past to show for it. Now our nations are just sitting ducks that can neither fly nor swim, with so many dilapidated factories not even worth bombing. The damage has already been done. And by a force within, why are so many of the new and very expensive vehicles of war we make already incapacitated with self-defeating mechanisms built into them? What kind of flaw crept into the design of them from their inventors to make them so faulty? This curse, see, he gets that right. This curse does begin with our sins as the unseen factor of the law we ignore. All manufacturing and business is marred to ruin without God being the CEO. See, without God guiding our leadership, can you even call it leadership? And so the money will continue to flow in. So long as the United States can continue to borrow, you can expect tens of billions of dollars to be redirected to the Pentagon, and you can expect the Pentagon to be cheering this, to be applauding this effort to rebuild the military, to make the American military great again. But what will be the reality? Just look at recent history. 15 years, this author writes in Real Clear World, 15 years and no victories yet, not one. And all of these generals, just like a revolving door, in and out, in and out, in and out. And looking at the bigger picture, well, there's another piece here just from yesterday in the New York Times Magazine, The End of the Anglo-American Order. Here, all of this coincides with America's exit from the national stage, the international stage, I should say. It all coincides with the end of the Anglo-American order. Yes, there is a new world order. It's taking shape even now. Coming out of World War II, it was the United States together with Britain. Even with a British Empire in decline, it was these two that pretty much shaped the world that we live in to this day. And now we see that world falling apart. And we see a new world order taking shape. Well, it's important to go, and if you look, for instance, in the Great Again book, the afterword there at the end of that booklet, it talks about some of this history we've paraphrased here today. America being the lone superpower for decades, establishing the world order coming out of World War II. But how that, just as the great empire that Britain once was, fell apart. Darkness is now descending on America as well. But there is hope, as my father talks about. I mean, there is a time of trouble in the short run. Daniel 12:1, Jeremiah 30, verse 6 and 7, Matthew 24, of course. But even that trouble is designed to bring us to God. And so for that reason, as I alluded to earlier, Jeremiah in the 31st chapter says, there is hope in the end. There is hope in the end. In fact, our nations, the very ones I'm talking about here today, Manasseh in particular, and Ephraim as well, they are actually going to be the leading nations of the world tomorrow. So there's hope in their end for sure. When we come back, we'll see if we can get through as many emails as possible that have stacked up here over the last few days. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. more than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
And now some of your emails here. This one here says, I've been a loyal listener from the beginning. I'm a father and a husband. I've been wanting to tell you for a long time how grateful I am for all the shows. They help me to be excited and able to handle all the issues we deal with every day. I'm an outside salesperson, and I listen whenever I can. I get so much value that when my contractors or customers call, I don't want to answer the call and miss any of the show. He says in parentheses that he usually calls back later. In any event, thanks, he says, for all the efforts. Well, we certainly don't want your business to suffer, but we appreciate the enthusiasm for the program. This one here from Baton Rouge, Louisiana says, first, I'd like to apologize that this is the first email I've written. I've been listening to TDRS daily since its inception. It wasn't until the father called me into the truth 9 years ago did I realize the importance of America, Britain, and Judah. My heart is saddened by the state of our country and the world. My heart is saddened just thinking of how we have hurt the Father in Christ with all the sin that has and is currently taking place. The love they have for us makes me want to live a life that is pleasing to them on a daily basis. He says, finally, I have to keep my mind on the beautiful vision of the world tomorrow and New Jerusalem. This is how I can have joy and happiness in the midst of all this madness. And well, then he brings out how that he could go on and on. But it's good to hear from another listener for the first time. This one here from Saskatchewan, Canada, in response to Monday's program on Fidel Castro. Love the comments from President Reagan, he says. As an update, judging by the response from average Canadians and some of the press, Prime Minister Trudeau is backpedaling and trying to defend his eulogy on Fidel Castro. He has, if you've seen some of the headlines, he's taken quite a hit. Which is good. Quite a hit for his comments following the death of Castro. And this listener brings out how that with a sporting event up in Canada, he was actually there to introduce the teams, and there were quite a few in the crowd that booed him because of those recent comments. So that's just to follow on what we talked about on Monday. Another one here from Tennessee. It says, I enjoy your radio shows on SoundCloud from my cell phone while I walk our dog and do the daily chores that chickens require, and as many other responders have mentioned, with my mind focused on such great messages, those chores sometimes don't last long enough for a whole show, but I can usually pause and get back to the same show during the next dog walk or lunch break. It says here, the messages encourage me to remember that we are here now for a great purpose, despite the more mundane tasks at hand. Thank you. And then one last thought here. Please say hello to Sam. Some love for Sam. Sam's not even with us today. We've got Jonathan sitting in. Sam isn't here to bask in the glory. Now maybe someone will send in a note about Jonathan. We'll see. In any event, maybe Sam will hear this later and appreciate your hello. It says, we think of him often and know he is no longer the little boy that lived in Manteno, wherever that is, I guess Illinois. It says, we're proud that he has learned lessons and grown up to have a hand in helping the work firsthand. Well, we do have a lot of skilled helpers assisting us that have come through the college program or are going through the college program, and we're very appreciative of the enthusiasm and energy that they bring, and skills as well, that they bring to these various departments in God's work. Another one here says, thank you for the most timely and instructive program. I couldn't help, but this is in response to the one we did last week, just before Thanksgiving, on how we've forgotten God. And this listener says, I couldn't help but reflect on it yesterday when I was in transit at JFK Airport. With about 8 hours to spare before catching a connecting flight, I took a train to Times Square, where I spent about an hour and a half walking around. It was an absolute jungle. People from every direction looking down at their mobile phones, several handbags filled with goodies, no doubt, consumerism to the max. I'm not trying to be judgmental, but I wonder if the people of Israel, in this case Manasseh, ever spare a thought today to reflect upon how they came to be the most blessed single nation on this earth. I live outside of North America, in what's referred to as the third world or developing countries, so it's easy to see how far advanced first world countries are in comparison to us. It's sad to see, though, how people in receipt of such abundant material blessings could let God drift out of the picture. But thankfully, in the not-too-distant future, he will be very much at the center of these nations again. Another one in response to that same program, We Have Forgotten God, says, very interesting program today. You sure packed a lot of information into it. I'll have to listen to it multiple times to digest it. I downloaded the program and will burn a CD. I also sent a link to some of my friends, so he's doing his part to spread the word. This one here from Newfoundland in Canada. With all that's happened since the election of Mr. Trump, I'm truly thankful to God for using the ministry to get out the message and to teach us. This is the time to remove sin, hold fast to God's truth, and do the daily. We're truly blessed to be living at this time in history to see God's hand moving his age to his end. It says KPCG has made it possible for listeners all around the world to hear God's message. This is all a true blessing. True blessing. It says later, I loved how you were saying from across the pond on TD that we're so close now, the world's so interconnected. When Germany takes the reins, it's only a matter of time till the Daniel 8 man arrives. Please continue to teach us to understand biblically the events as they unfold in this ever-changing world. It says finally, so from St. John's, Newfoundland, a dedicated listener eagerly awaits for the next show to be uploaded to the site. Well, I've got a handful of others, but I don't have the time to get through all of them, so hopefully we can cover some more ground on the email front later on this week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to have your email read on the air, just send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.